You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, our next guest says, forget your idea of a proper dinner and choose what you want to cook and eat instead. She'll tell us about her new cookbook, Dinner, a Game Changer.
First on Monday, the Congressional Budget Office released the much-anticipated report on the costs and impacts of the American Health Care Act. That's the Republican proposal to replace the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare. Some aspects of the CBO report have gotten a lot of attention, like their estimate that 24 million people would lose health care within a decade after implementation, and that the deficit would be lowered by $337 billion during that same period.
The budget office has also assigned price tags and consequences to other aspects of the GOP proposal. One item is barring Planned Parenthood from receiving federal funds. Sandhya Somashekar joins us now. She's a social change reporter for The Washington Post. Sandhya, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first of all, talk about where federal money comes from to go toward Planned Parenthood.
Sure. Well, essentially, what we're talking about is Medicaid funds. People who have Medicaid can go to Planned Parenthood to get care, and Planned Parenthood gets reimbursed by the federal government for the care that they provide. And right now, the amount of money that flows into Planned Parenthood affiliates from the Medicaid program is about $500 million.
And how many people do we know receive service via this Medicaid funding through Planned Parenthood?
Well, we know a large percentage of Planned Parenthood patients do come in through Medicaid, and they serve about 2.5 million men and women nationally. Now, it's important to point out, however, that federal funds cannot be used for abortions by law. So we're talking about the other services that Planned Parenthood provides, so STD testing, cancer screenings, contraception prescriptions, that kind of thing.
Right, and the argument from critics of Planned Parenthood say, well, that just takes that funding, makes up those parts, they can use other funding toward abortion services. Is that kind of the general argument from people who want to cut this federal funding?
Yeah, essentially they feel like, Planned Parenthood does also provide over 300,000 abortions a year. They're the nation's biggest abortion provider. And so abortion critics don't really want any support from federal or taxpayer support to go to this organization that's responsible for so many abortions.
As the American Health Care Act, this House Republican proposal, stands right now, what would happen to funding to Planned Parenthood?
The bill would basically make Planned Parenthood ineligible for these Medicaid funds that we're talking about for a year. And so if you're a patient that goes to Planned Parenthood using under the Medicaid program, you would no longer be able to use the program to get your care there. And the impact of this would be that a huge number of patients probably would have to stop going to Planned Parenthood, and some health centers would probably have to close.
And that's an interesting point, that this would be a cut for 1 year. Do you know why that time frame was specified here?
Well, there are some questions about how what will happen. I mean, clearly, if this happens, there are going to be some legal challenges. And there's a federal law that requires basically, it's a patient's rights law that requires patients to be able to get care from places that are able to provide good care. And so there are some questions about whether this would really hold legal muster.
Sandhya Somashekar is with us from The Washington Post, looking at changes to Planned Parenthood funding, a cut for a year under the House Republican proposal. And Sandhya, the Congressional Budget Office ran the numbers on this whole thing. What did they see? What kind of outcomes, impacts did they see specifically from this cut to Planned Parenthood?
So they do see a savings here of about $178 million for this year. But essentially that means that's because it would be less care provided under the Medicaid program. And interestingly, they think that money, though, that savings would be partially offset by the fact that the women who would have gotten care that would have prevented pregnancy will actually have babies. So they're predicting actually that several thousand more babies will be born as a result of this change and that maybe some of those babies would actually qualify for Medicaid as well. So there is a savings, but not quite as much as you might think because more babies will be born.
And as far as access to the kind of services Planned Parenthood provides, did the Congressional Budget Office look at where the impact might be strongest, might be greatest regionally in the country?
They did. I mean, they looked at, they predicted that the biggest impact would be in low-income and rural communities, places that have a already have a shortage of medical care. Those are the areas that would be most greatly impacted.
Getting back to that additional cost, I mean, how people have questioned the Congressional Budget Office numbers more generally for the Affordable Health Care Act. How did they come to this this idea of how many more births there might be and how much that would cost the system?
Well, you know, this is what they do. Their whole mission is assessing the fiscal impact of bills, and they're kind of paid to make these predictions. That's their job. And a lot of people have criticized this. Some critics of Planned Parenthood say, great, we want to see more babies born. This is a good thing. Others don't think it's actually fair to say that women will be left without care because there are other health centers that get federal money that they say could help fill the void and provide care for these women. And they'd actually like to see some of the savings that are created actually be given to these organizations so that they can help provide services for these women who are left without care.
Yeah, is there any indication that either as this bill gets modified, as it goes through the procedure, that kind of funding might be added using this savings to fund other services, or that, you know, this isn't the only part of health care reform efforts from Republicans, that this is something they might tackle in a separate bill?
I mean, that's a good question. As you know, there are a lot of questions about how this whole thing is going to unfold generally at this point. And so, you know, that could very well be something that could be added at some point.
Politically, does it seem so far like this is a big point of conflict over the American Health Care Act, or are people more looking at the overall who's covered, who's not issues?
Well, it's a priority. It's been outlined as a priority by Republican leadership in Congress to, quote unquote, defund Planned Parenthood. It's been on the top of their wish list for a really long time. Last year, there was actually a vote to defund Planned Parenthood. It passed both chambers, and President Obama vetoed it. So you would think that it would happen again, but, you know, the votes are very close, especially in the Senate. And, you know, we've already heard from some senators that they're uncomfortable with other aspects of the health bill. And so the people who are uncomfortable with defunding Planned Parenthood, plus the people who are uncomfortable with other aspects of the bill, they could add up to a pretty big barrier to get this passed. But that said, you know, we just don't know what's going to happen going forward here.
You mentioned possible legal challenges if this goes through. We've seen in states with certain kinds of cuts to Planned Parenthood, legal challenges from Planned Parenthood and its supporters. Do you expect to see at the federal level a big legal pushback on this?
Absolutely. There will be legal pushback. And in fact, the ACLU, which has been a leader in opposing President Trump's agenda, has already promised to defend Planned Parenthood against some of these cuts.
We'll leave it there for now. Sandhya, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Sandhya Somashekar is a social change reporter at The Washington Post. She joined us to talk about the increases in births that the Congressional Budget Office is predicting under the GOP's replacement plan for Obamacare, looking specifically at cuts to Planned Parenthood, 1 year of cutting Medicaid support to people who use Planned Parenthood services, and what the Congressional Budget Office had to say about the impact of that change.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Americans work too many hours for not enough pay, according to our guests. They say we need to turn that around.
Now the way we eat is changing. Instead of the old formula, protein plus two sides, we're more inclined to think of meals as something more flexible and subject to how much time we have or what we feel like eating. Sheet pan dinners are one example of this, where the protein and the vegetables and the sauce are all roasted up together, or there could be a couple of smaller dishes plus a salad.
Thing is, most cookbooks aren't really written that way. They're generally divided up into the appetizer section, the soups, the salads, the entrees over here, and the desserts back at the end.
Melissa Clark is out to make dinner a little more reflective of how we eat now. She's in touch with a network of home cooks through her job as a food writer for the New York Times and the author of several cookbooks. Her new book is called Dinner, Changing the Game. Melissa, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Well, you say that there's a void between what we think of as a proper meal. This is the idea of the protein and then a couple of sides, and what we actually want to cook and want to eat for dinner. Why do you think there is that gulf between the two?
You know, I think that people are so used to the meals that their moms made, which might have been great, you know. But a protein and two sides, it's only one way that people can eat dinner. There are so many ways to eat dinner. And I think we get trapped in that root, just, you know, thinking about childhood and also thinking about what's around us culturally. But there's so many different ways to enjoy your food. And I know that when I go out, and I think this is true of a lot of people, we mix it up. You know, we'll go out to dinner and we're not afraid to order two sides and four appetizers and no entree at all. Or maybe we'll split it three entrees between, you know, six people and then get a bunch of desserts. But at home, we feel very much like it's not a proper meal unless we have the three distinct piles on the plate. You know, your steak, your mashed potatoes, your peas. And there's nothing wrong with eating that way, but it is limiting. And what I wanted to help people do was break out of those limitations.
And how do you do that? How do you get us to eat a little more flexibly and to not worry so much about the composition?
Well, first of all, the most important thing is to really focus on what you want to eat for dinner. You know, I think a lot of us don't think about what we're hungry for. You know, we kind of ignore our bodies and we just think about what we should eat. So step number one for everyone is, what are you hungry for? You know, maybe you're hungry for just a giant head of cauliflower that is roasted in the oven at super high heat till it gets all crunchy with tons of chili sauce all over it. And you pile that on a big bowl of rice sauteed with shallots. That's delicious. And that's dinner. That can be dinner just as much as anything else. Of course, in the book, you know, in the cookbook, I have 220 recipes for, you know, an expansion of what we think of as dinner.
When I think of this idea about letting there be lots of maybe little things or just one star thing, it reminds me a little bit about how my kids prefer to eat. They like there to be lots of interest and different focal points and not just one star, like a turkey on a table. They'll usually care less about that turkey, but they're more interested in the little things. And those are the things that we eat. Is there something there that reminds you of being free to eat what you want to be and being free of these rules, maybe the way a kid thinks of eating?
It's true. You know, a kid is not afraid to take her chicken nugget and dunk it right in her strawberry jam. You know what I mean? They're very free that way. And we'd be horrified. Like, what are you doing? You're not supposed to do that.
Uh-huh.
But if you think of the Thanksgiving, like you just mentioned, turkey and cranberry sauce is actually not that far off. One way for people to expand their choices on the dinner table and their experience of eating dinner without doing any extra work is to buy condiments. I am a full believer in having a fridge full of delicious condiments that will last for a really long time so they won't go bad and will add interest to your meal without you having to do anything. For example, kimchi. You know, kimchi is something that is not that hard to find. It'll last for months in your fridge. And just a little bit put it on a salad, put it on your steak or your chicken nugget, and it transforms the meal without you having to do anything. Other than, you know, think ahead and buy it.
Right. You have a whole bunch of suggestions about those things that can amp up the flavor profile and help us cook in new ways. You named one, kimchi, harissa is another, garlic chili paste. What are some of the others that you think we should stock up on?
I think pomegranate molasses is a great one because it's very inexpensive. It is incredibly delicious. Pomegranate molasses tastes sweet and tart at the same time. It's got a fruity flavor, and it lasts forever in your pantry. It doesn't even take up fridge space. So I'd say invest in a bottle of that. And if you can't find it, here's a trick. You can take pomegranate juice, you know, regular old palm that you buy at the supermarket, and cook it down until it's really, really sludge. Like it looks like molasses. It should look like molasses. and then you can store that, store that one in your fridge. That will last forever. Put it in any salad dressing you make. A few drops if you want a sort of sweet sour taste in a dressing. You know, if sometimes people put honey in their salad dressings, think pomegranate molasses because you get the sweetness, but you get so much more.
Well, let's talk about one of your recipes, and this is one there will be a link to on the Central Time Facebook page as we talk right now with Melissa Clark about her new cookbook. It's called Dinner Changing the Game, and you have a recipe for harissa chicken with leeks, potatoes, and yogurt, and this is this idea of a sheet pan dinner. Everything is on the one pan.
Don't you love having fewer dishes to clean up after you make dinner? That is what one of my big focuses when I'm thinking about what I want to make for dinner is how few pans can I use to get there. And a sheet pan supper is great because you throw everything on the same pan and you put it in the oven and it cooks at the same time. So when you pull that sheet pan out, you have caramelized leeks, you have tender, crunchy edged potatoes, and you have gorgeous chicken with crispy skin. And then on top of that, that has all been marinated with a harissa, a chili paste spice mix. And then you add yogurt sauce right on top. And yogurt sauce, by the way, is something everybody should know how to make. Take yogurt, add salt and chopped garlic, and you are done. And it just makes everything taste better. So that's the kind of meal, one pan, super easy, but so delicious. I serve that for dinner parties, not just for after work.
So how long does a meal like that take to cook? So people are busy, and when everything's on the one sheet pan, definitely your cleanup is easier. How about the prep and the cooking?
Well, you know, so that one does take a little bit of time in the oven because, you know, you've got your chicken and your potatoes. So it won't cook quickly. But the good thing about it is that you won't need to do anything while it's cooking. You can go and you can, you know, help your kids with their homework. You can answer some emails. You can wipe up, you know, the kitchen or whatever you want to do. And so it's free time. So I don't mind things that take, you know, maybe 40 minutes to cook as long as you don't need to stand there over the stove stirring.
Right. I feel exactly the same way. Once it's in there, I'm okay with it. It's just getting it in there. Well, you have another recipe. You've got it divided up, by the way, into, you know, instead of appetizers, soup, salads, entrees, you have it divided into chicken. You have, that's your first section. And then you have steak and red meat. And there's an egg section and a tofu section. I mean, it's very different this way of thinking about it. And in your fish section, you have a recipe for fish tacos. And this is one that's really popular right now, fish tacos. A lot of the time, though, the fish is fried, which can be messy. It can take a little while. How did you approach fish tacos?
You know, I love fish tacos so much, I would eat them every day, except that I don't want to fry them. I just don't. I mean, I love cooking things in the oven that normally you would fry because, you know, it does use a little less fat, but that's not even the real reason. It's because it's faster. It's, well, not necessarily faster, but it's easier in terms of cleanup. It's easier in terms of you're not standing there, you know, watching everything fry. So you can do other things. And I really think that for something like a fish taco, you know, for something like a French fry, I think frying it is actually worthwhile because you're getting this incredible crunch. But for a fish taco, you're placing that fried fish, or in this case, this baked fish that is crunchy on the outside, and you're putting it in a taco. You're putting it in a tortilla. You're putting different salsas on it, right? You're putting maybe some shredded cabbage or some lettuce on it. You're putting kind of wet stuff in there, so it's not going to stay crisp very long anyway. So I really feel like the experience of eating it, you get some crunch because you are roasting it at high heat, but the experience of eating a fish taco is all the different textures. And so you have, you know, the freshness from the salsa, you have the heat, you have the tortilla, which should be warm, and all of those things still make for an amazing meal, and it's just so much easier.
Your house won't
smell like fried fish, which is always a plus.
That can be a plus. Melissa, do you have a favorite recipe in this cookbook?
You know, I don't. That would be like asking me if I had a favorite child, although I do have a favorite child because I just have one. So she is my favorite. But no, I don't have a favorite, but I have a recipe that I want to tell everybody about because I'm afraid they're going to overlook it. It's for pan-fried Brussels sprouts and halloumi cheese, which sounds really weird, and it tastes so great. Fried halloumi cheese. I mean, who doesn't love fried cheese, right?
So it's Wisconsin not fried, you're talking
pan-fry
to.
It. The cheese gets a little bit soft on the edges. It is crispy. It is so tasty. And then with the Brussels sprouts, which also get browned, and they turn very sweet when you cook them at high heat, the whole thing is so good, extremely unusual, and takes about, I think, 14 minutes to make. So fast, easy, unusual, you can probably get all of the ingredients in your local store. If you can't find halloumi, you can substitute another kind of firm cheese. So that's a winner, and I'm afraid, you know, people might skip over it. So don't, try it. Tell me how you like it.
Well, it's Wisconsin, so it's not hard to sell fried cheese here, so that's a plus.
Use cheese curds, exactly. You could totally use cheese curds. Well, in that recipe.
As we wrap up, you say that cooking dinner should be one of the best, most pleasurable parts of the day. It shouldn't be rushed and stressful. How do we make it something that's that pleasurable?
It's all about giving yourself permission to enjoy it. Take 15 minutes, make sure that you've carved out that time as your time, and make that your dinner prep time, and put on your favorite music. Open a bottle of wine and drink it while you're cooking. Be in the moment and really enjoy the process. And don't be distracted. Don't think about work tomorrow. Don't think about all the other things that you need to do. Spend those 15 minutes just doing your thing. I mean, if you love to cook, there's no reason why you shouldn't at least enjoy cooking dinner, at least some of the time.
Melissa, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Melissa Clark is a food writer for The New York Times and the author of several cookbooks, including her newest, Dinner Changing the Game. She'll be speaking in Madison on Thursday night at 7:30 at the Madison Central Public Library.
Coming up, the latest in an occasional series on the future of work in America. Our guests say Americans should work less and get paid more. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up tonight after 7, it's Storytelling with a Beat on Snap Judgment. Tonight's theme, Full Circle. Amazing stories about ending up exactly where you got started. That's tonight after 7 on the Ideas Network.
First, it's no secret that there are some major ongoing changes in the American labor market. Automation is changing the nature of a lot of jobs and making others obsolete. And manufacturing jobs for many people are giving way to service work in fields like retail and healthcare, often with lower pay.
And as we heard last week from a UW economist, wages are going in two directions. People at the top of the scale with higher levels of education are seeing increases in pay, while people with no education past high school are seeing stagnant wages over time. And if people at the lower end want to make more money, the only answer is to work more jobs and longer hours.
Our next guests say we need to rethink the work week and salaries in the American economy with a goal of working fewer hours for more money. Dorothy Sue Cobble is a distinguished professor of labor studies and history at Rutgers University. Dorothy Sue, thanks for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
And Michael Merrill is with us. He's a professor of professional practice and LEARN director at the Rutgers Labor Education Center. Michael, welcome to the show.
Hi, Rob. Nice to be here.
Well, Dorothy Sue, I want to start with the opening line of a piece that you wrote. This is a couple years back. You started, "Most Americans work too much and are paid too little." Can you spell that out for us?
Well, I think most of us know that we're working longer hours. And as you said in your introduction, certainly some people are making a lot more money, but most of us, wages are stagnating, and we're having to work harder just to stay in place.
And Michael, what's led to that trend over time?
Well, I mean, it's basically the decline in the bargaining power of wage earners, and that bargaining power obviously is both a function of organization and structure of the labor market. I also think what's important here is that actually the link between work and income has been separated for a long time, ever since actually the Industrial Revolution, or at least the rise of corporate forms and complex organizations. And the power and relations in the labor market just haven't kept up with those changes. We're making people work very hard for very little money, and some people work hardly at all for a lot.
Dorothy Sue, what would be some of the things that might turn that trend around? Have we seen actually changes over time where maybe that was less true?
You know, one of the things that's often said is, well, Americans work much longer hours than people in other countries because that's just the way we are. You know, we work harder. And I think that's one way of thinking about a work ethic, that, you know, we're hard workers. But a shorter hours movement that was a very American movement that actually affected American policy as well as European, believed that there was a different kind of work ethic, that Americans should be paid fairly for the work they do, and their work time should be valued. So one of the things I've written about is how we haven't always had long hours and low pay, that we changed that situation 100 years ago, and we can do it again.
And Dorothy Sue, you mentioned European countries. How do we stack up with other developed countries when it comes to the amount of time we work and how much we get paid for it?
Well, probably many of your listeners are aware that we're one of the few countries in the world that does not have a paid parental leave policy. These kinds of policies are very common around the world. The norm is really 3 months of paid leave. That's the world norm. But you take more advanced industrial countries, you know, that are more our counterparts, like Germany and Sweden, places like that. They have much better policies that address work time. Germany, one example, they have 6 weeks of mandated vacation time. And, you know, I should just emphasize that this doesn't make them less productive. It makes them more productive. We work about 1,400 hours a year. They work about 1,400 hours a year. We work about 1,800. And they are producing just as much or more.
So, Michael, how do we get there from here? You mentioned briefly labor organization earlier. Is that part of the story? We don't have the unions, the organized labor we once did?
Oh, well, that's certainly part of the story. I think also it's important to get our heads around the larger structural changes that we need. I mean, I've come to think that we treat unemployment not as the public scandal it should be, that we need to treat unemployment as a public health emergency and respond to any case of unemployment the same way we would respond to a case of cholera. We'd cure it. We'd make sure that the system worked so it didn't happen. And there are ways of doing that. If we can eliminate, I think, job blackmail, what I would call job blackmail, we increase the bargaining power of individual workers, whether or not they're in a union. Unions are essential to get those kinds of changes. They're essential to bargain in large organizations. But obviously, unionization has fallen quite sharply, and much of our bargaining power individual is a function of the structure of the market, which is what I think we need to change.
Talking to Michael Merrill and Dorothy Sue Cobble, both from Rutgers University, looking at the future of work. They say many of us work too long, too many hours, don't get paid enough for doing that. We should get paid more and work less. Michael, you mentioned labor blackmail. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean job blackmail. Many people take work longer hours than they want to because they are forced to work those hours to make the money they need to live the life that they're told every time they turn on the television or listen to the radio they're supposed to live. When the shorter hour movement started in the labor movement in the 19th century, Ira Stewart was sort of the godfather of the movement, had this slogan, shorten your day and raise your pay. And what he, among the other things that he meant to capture there, was that people who don't work long hours have a whole host of other needs and are deserving of more money to support those needs, education, leisure, and political. And I would say that if you look actually at the structure of pay in large organizations, at least every time I've asked wage earners this question, the link between your contribution to getting the product or service out the door and your pay is often skewed. We need to have a whole different set of pay systems. And if people can walk away from a bad job at a bad pay because there's another one available for them, we'd get there.
And Dorothy Sue, Michael is mentioning unemployment. Would having all of us work fewer hours make for more employment? And if instead of one person working 70 hours a week, two people are working 35 hours a week?
Right. you know, I've written a lot about the early labor movement in the 19th and early 20th century, and one of the leaders, Sam Gompers, often said that the hours of labor are too long as one person is out of work. And for the labor movement at that point, shorter hours they saw as a solution not just to overwork, but to underwork, that some people were working too long and some people were not working enough. So you really needed to think about redistributing time as well as redistributing money.
We're talking to Dorothy Sue Cobble and Michael Merrill at Rutgers University, looking at the future of work and labor in the American economy. They say one of our main goals should be to have shorter hours, fewer hours in the work week and the work year, and better pay, especially for workers in lower paying jobs.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the case our guests are making? Do you think this could happen? If you're working in a lower paying service sector job, tell us your story. What kind of hours do you work? What's the pay like? And what are the challenges? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up a conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're continuing our conversation about the future of work. Our guests say we should rethink our economy and aim for shorter hours and higher pay, especially for workers at the lowest end of the pay scale. Dorothy Sue Cobble and Michael Merrill are with us from Rutgers University.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you see a need for some kind of labor organizing for lower paid service sector jobs? Do you think we should rethink the work week, how long it should be, what we get paid? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers now. Charlie is with us in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. While I'm sympathetic to the view, and Henry Ford famously said, you know, if you don't pay your workers enough to buy the product, your workers are not going to buy your product. So you need to have your workers paid appropriately for the work they do. But at what point does the worker outprice himself from the job? An example would be if we gave everyone in the fast food restaurant business $20 an hour, so to speak, at what point does the fast food franchise, you know, put in kiosks so that they're the ones taking the orders because people are going to demand cheaper food rather than the more expensive burger?
Charlie, thanks a lot for that call. An interesting point, Dorothy Sue, the idea that either if wages go up too much, A, the small business person, in this case, the franchise owner, couldn't stay in business, or it gives them an incentive to join the wave of automation, and then we don't have enough jobs again.
Right. Yes, certainly, I suppose there's a point you could reach at which people are overpaid. I don't think we've reached that yet. When people are working full-time and working hard and still can't make enough money to support themselves and their families, and we have extreme inequalities of wealth so that a few people are really making enormous money, and that is not trickling down. I think we've seen profits go up. I think there's room for redistribution of some of those profits. I also think when people are paid more, it's actually better for everybody. It spurs the economy. It spurs growth. And it's a win-win situation.
Brian, Charlie, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Brian on the line in Milwaukee. Brian, hi.
Hi.
What do you think?
I think her point about the wage inequality is spot on, but I'm a union worker out of Milwaukee, and I'm a sewer worker, actually, and there are days when I'm down in a hole dealing with other people's poop and everything else that goes through the line, and there's days I think I can't possibly make enough money to justify doing this, but yet I have no choice because I have three kids at home. I have to go home and feed. And then, but the reason I was mainly calling is I've been in the union for about 20 years, and I always thought that when I got in, I was told that union workers are a higher caliber of worker, and you're getting the best quality for your work. And just in the last few years, I've really seen that going downhill. I've got people that, you know, they criticize me for being union, saying that, oh, you're overpaid and you're causing everything else to go up, and the price of sewer and water is directly because you make too much money, which I just don't see. I see people running the companies making millions of dollars, you know, profits-wise, but yet paying us less and less every year. And then, to me, these people come after me like it's my fault. And they can't even comprehend what I do for a living, but yet they degrade me for it. You know, at what point did that become, I mean, is this something that's been going on for years? I mean, I'm not even 40 yet, so I really can't tell what happened, you know, when the labor movement first kicked in.
And Brian, I'll jump in. And Michael, let's bring you in on this. Brian sees labor unions becoming more and more of a dirty word. Is this a new trend or something that we've been working toward for a while?
Well, it's been a trend for a while, obviously, but there have been ups and downs. I mean, the problem, we are in a sort of a downward vicious spiral, and it's very hard to solve the problem in one place without solving it everywhere. I mean, one of the images that I often use is that we have started to organize our society like a game of musical chairs, and we purposely don't have enough chairs. And some people with ringside seats, you know, that some of which they're already reserved for them, they get to laugh at the rest of us who fight and claw to get the few that are left. And until we change that basic structural fact, we will engender these kinds of resentments. We'll engender desperate people trying to think of all these solutions, and I think we'll be in a downward spiral. There are solutions. I mean, we have had historical experience with full employment when we were motivated to employ everybody who wanted to work in World War II. Prices rose, but wages rose. Real wages climbed steeply from 1939 to 1945 and kept going up for the next 10 or 15 years because we jump-started a virtuous cycle of growth. And we've now fallen into a vicious cycle of decline. And the only way to fix it is to jumpstart a new virtuous cycle of growth, which will take massive spending, which the people with money are reluctant to do, but we'll all be better off.
Brian, thanks for that call. We're talking to Michael Merrill and Dorothy Sue Cobble from Rutgers University, looking at the future of work. They say, in a nutshell, Americans work too many hours and don't get paid enough for it. They'd like to reverse that equation. Back to your calls now with Fawn on the line in Platteville. Fawn, hi.
Hi.
What do you think?
I just had a comment. You know, a lot of people now, even if you're either a single parent or it's a dual income, if you're not on a higher paid job, you still have to pay daycare. So even if you're making X amount of dollars an hour, you still have to pay X amount of hours for your child because it's not easy to have just a single income to cover all the bills.
Fawn, thanks for the call. Dorothy Sue, the cost of children for people trying to work while raising children.
Right. One of the things I've written about is what I call the other women's movement. There have been a lot of different women's movements in the U.S. We celebrate the suffrage movement for political rights, but there was also a long women's movement to raise pay. Women are still the lowest paid workers. They're two-thirds of all minimum wage workers. And they're increasingly single heads of families, so they're supporting themselves and their children. And one of the things the women's movement pushed for in the past, and I think we're seeing increasingly organizations pushing for this and achieving some of these things today, are better social supports for parents. Like other countries with paid parental leave, but also social supports for, after school programs and kindergarten and other ways of helping caregivers who have to take care of children and increasingly the elderly.
Thanks a lot for the call, Fawn. I wanted to ask about this transition, more and more service-type jobs. A lot of these jobs, just staying with the issue of women, Dorothy Sue, a lot of them are traditionally thought of as women, healthcare, retail service-type jobs, lower regarded in some cases, lower paid in many cases. Do we need to change an attitude of the kind of work people are doing to be worth this kind of reward?
Yes. I think one of the things that's really troubling to me is I'm in my 60s, and when I grew up in a world in which it seemed that the work people did, whether it was blue-collar, manual, care work, was valued. And now, increasingly, we seem to have a world where only a few jobs are valued, that one has to be white-collar, professional, and other jobs are not as valued. And I think how we think about work does matter in terms of how we pay and value it. So public attitudes really do matter in terms of service wages. I think also those jobs have been underpaid in part because of discrimination. Who does those jobs? Their roots in notions that this is the kind of work that was done for free in the home. It was part of a gift economy, and those skills were seen as natural and not valued. So it's a very complicated problem. It's also a really important problem because more and more people do those jobs, and we're not going to see more general prosperity and wage equality until we start revaluing that work.
That's all the time we have for now. Dorothy Sue, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
And Michael, thanks to you as well for being with us.
Sure, Rob. Thank you.
We've been talking to Dorothy Sue Cobble, Distinguished Professor of Labor Studies and History at Rutgers University, and Michael Merrill, Professor of Professional Practice at the Rutgers Labor Education Center, looking at the future of work, the hours we work, what we get paid for them. Still time for you to share your thoughts and your experiences over at the Central Time Facebook page.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.